Welcome to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast with your hosts, Jane and Amanda. I'm Jane, a licensed psychotherapist and alcohol-free retreat host.
And I'm Amanda, alcohol-free lifestyle coach and yoga instructor. We're so glad you're here.
Today, we are interviewing Jonathan Boyd on the podcast. Jonathan is from Michigan, currently spending some time in West Texas. Jonathan is a runner. He practices yoga and he loves to hike. He also is a foodie. Jonathan is a recovery coach and is also sober himself.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so glad to have you here.
You got it. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. Yes. So just a little bit about you. So you and Amanda know each other through bicycle recovery. Is that right?
Yeah, bicycle health. We joined in December in the same cohort, both as recovery coaches. So we've not been there too long. What is it? I guess coming up on 3 months, I suppose. So
yeah.
Yeah. And interestingly, and I don't know if Amanda feels this way, but we were sort of a part of this first round of hiring that has since really ramped up. So even though we're new, there are so many people who started after we did. So
they're newer than you.
Yeah, it gives the sense that we've been there, or for me anyway, it gives the sense that I've been there for quite some time, much longer than 3 months. It's interesting.
Yeah, nice. You've already got some seniority.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm training, you know, we're doing trainings and, you know, we know more terminology than most of the other folks. So yeah, it's a confidence booster. It feels like I'm quite the expert sometimes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we are just so pleased that you agreed to come on and share a little bit about your story and how you became involved in the recovery field. So to start out, can you tell us just a little bit about early life for you, kind of what life looked like for you early on?
Yeah. Just to maybe start backwards, you know, we just mentioned my role as a recovery coach. I've been working in recovery professionally for 5 years or so. And the seeds to this career were planted very, very early on. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and alcoholism is a sort of a family heirloom. You know, not alone there. Obviously, it's not a it's a relatively common story, I feel, for somebody who's been in recovery a long time and has had many recovery conversations. You kind of learn that a lot, this type of life starts early on. And those early years when you don't really know what's going on. It's totally formative for doing things like social work, doing things like addiction work. Developing the, obviously there's the unfortunate sort of dysfunctional characteristics of those types of families, but there's also a level of empathy, I think, that you start to learn at a really young age too, in that
for
environment
sure.
That I think has
absolutely
been, an important component of my personality, that's brought kind of a sort of natural skill set into working as a recovery professional.
Like having that trait of empathy. It's not like a state that you have to work to cultivate. It's just kind of a trait that you developed early on, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I don't have all of those answers. A lot of these things, these are conclusions I've just come to. I think about my childhood a lot. I think about my life a lot. Working in recovery and being in recovery, it's like holding a mirror up often. You know, you're seeing similar stories kind of play out to your own. Obviously,
for sure.
We're all unique. We have our own journey, et cetera, you know, but we're connected. We're definitely connected. We have a common kind of this golden common thread that connects everybody in recovery one way or the other. So it leads to a lot of introspection, you know, being around other folks who have had a similar life path. And so
for sure.
I think a lot of that introspection, especially when you're just doing it, when you're, you know, running or cooking or, you know, just in the midst of kind of another daily activity, it's not guided by another professional. I think you can arrive at maybe some conclusions that change or aren't accurate. They're certainly not, you know, 100% objective because it's just, you know, me and my thoughts and my own experience and kind of trying to figure out this or figure out that. But it's all a part of this big, interesting construct that I think
for sure.
a person with a kind of a, this background, this family background, and this personal history of alcohol use disorder, it provides a certain level of levity to it that I've needed as a way to cope with kind of some of the difficult truths that have come along with the life as well.
Yeah. Like a sense of humor helps. It's like, is a wonderful coping skill. Yeah. And even just, I can tell it's there, even you calling it like a family heirloom. It's like, you know, sometimes we just have to laugh about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And my siblings are the same. You know, we've had kind of an irreverent sense of humor about, you know, some aspects of our upbringing. And and just to be clear, you know, there was some really wonderful childhood times too. A lot of love and a lot of support and a lot of, you know, a lot of sense of humor, a lot, you know, education and really important lessons were also taught too. It wasn't just, you know, some of those edgier kind of, maybe, you know, I hate to use the word too often, but sort of dysfunctional or chaotic, you know, some of those chaotic stretches of time when relationships aren't working and coping mechanisms aren't working while you're trying to, you know, raise a family and, you know, make it in the world. And lot of good, lot of, you know, bad or challenging situations, you know, those things kind of existed at the same time.
Where were you in the birth order of your family?
I'm the baby.
Which the lane
I'm
the,
young,
with,
I'm
you're
the youngest.
The baby. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a.
Okay.
Yeah, an older brother and an older sister. My older brother's 5 years older than me, and my sister's about 3.5 years older than me.
Okay. And did you grow up in West Texas?
We all were in the Houston area until my parents divorced. And I think that was like early 90s. So I was maybe 10 or 11. And then my mom and I moved out here to the desert. And my sister joined us a couple of years later, and then my brother eventually moved out here. So it's kind of a slower trickle for them. But after the divorce, my mom and I moved out here, and I went to middle school and high school in this part of the state.
So that must have been a little bit of a culture shock to be like in a bigger city area. Even the weather, it's hot and humid, there's pine trees, and then you are in like the dry desert area that's also really beautiful. It's been very different, more remote.
It is very different. It's totally different. It really remote, really, really, really remote. I'm in a small town called Alpine, which is about 100 miles from the Mexican border, 3.5 hours east of El Paso, 2.5 hours, 3 hours sort of southwest of Midland. And those are kind of the two cities. So, and everything in between all of that is just desert. There's not a lot going on. So coming from the Houston area, where, you know, it's, there is no bare land. It's all developed.
Yeah.
Out here it was kind of the inverse, of landscapes. And then of course the local culture is totally different too. The demographics are different. Ways of life are different. You know, Houston's petrochemical. My dad worked in petrochemical. You know, there's NASA and medical and, you know, those sort of bigger industries. And out here, you know, there's really not a lot. There's a university, but it's just, you know, slower paced, much more quiet. And I loved it. I did. I loved it. You know, I loved some aspects of it right away. I was different, which had its sort of drawback, its pros and cons, I'll say. I did feel like I kind of thrived in that role of being the city boy that kind of showed up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And had a really wonderful experience out here as a young person. Bunch of friends and, you know, beautiful desert to run around in and, you know, rattlesnakes to cut the heads off of. And
It's a pretty magical place. I've been to Marfa, which it was probably been like 12 years ago.
Okay.
And I'm sure it's been built up even more since then. But when I went, it was probably built up much more than it was when you first came as a kid.
Yeah, Marfa in particular, I guess Alpine too, maybe to a lesser degree, but Marfa has become a major destination for kind of art tourism. So there's all kinds of interesting folks that come into the area for specifically what Marfa has to offer. And that was not the case when I came out here in the early 90s. There's a minimalism movement in Marfa that started a long time ago, I think in the 70s, by an artist named Donald Judd. But that didn't really gain. And if there's any art historians listening to this podcast, they may say I'm way off. But chronologically, the sort of movement that he started didn't really, as far as I'm concerned, gained popularity until maybe the early 2000s, mid-2000s. So a lot of change has happened since then.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned you have been a recovery coach for the last 5 years or so. What were you doing before that?
I worked in food pretty much exclusively, some measure of food service, everything you can imagine from, every job that a kitchen has to offer, front and back of the house, did that for many years and worked in coffee, worked in catering, worked in hotels briefly. I've had my own businesses, cafes, food delivery businesses, farmers market business. Now I have a private chef, small private chef, private dinner company that I run with my wife. We do that just a couple of months out of the year, three kind of the busy season in the Michigan area where I'm from. Mm-hmm. So food has been since I was, 17, 18, up until this morning, cooking breakfast. It's been a major part of my life.
A major part of your life. Yeah. And that industry in particular is somewhat known for also being paired with alcoholic beverages and kind of nightlife and the party scene. And I'm curious, what was that like for you?
Well, it's a part of your payment in a lot of cases,
yeah.
You get paid in alcohol. And when you're 18 and that was one of the things that drew me to the business. It was so fun. It was so fun to go to work and work really hard. And it's really exciting and, it's really stressful, but that kind of stress can be kind of a rush. The dinner rush and the tickets spitting out of the machine and people kind of yelling at each other and, the camaraderie that builds up around that kind of energy.
Almost like a chaotic family, probably.
It's very similar. It's absolutely similar to a chaotic family. There's no question about it. And that analogy's not been lost on me for quite some time. So it was great. It was great. I loved it. It's all I wanted to do. I can remember thinking when I first started working in the industry, how or why anybody would want to do anything else. The people that would come into restaurants and from any number of professional fields, I just always wondered, man, you must be so bored at that job. And
I do that all day long.
So, it was so good. It was such a. While I was not aware of the toxicity building in my life, kind of in the background, that low level hum of addiction, kind of really starting to blossom. The first 3 or 4 years of working in kitchens was so exciting and so great. And I still hold that kind of close. The industry has, kind of crested and fallen for me over the years. And I've become completely disenchanted, with it, and frustrated with it. And, there's been some self-loathing, that I have wrapped up in my career as a food professional. But I've come out of that, the last few years and, Yeah, it's been a hell of a it's been a hell of an experience. Yeah, working in food.
Yeah. Well, was there a turning point for you where you realized that some parts of it weren't fun, that parts of it were toxic, and maybe there were changes that you were feeling maybe needed to be made in your life?
Yeah, there was a kind of a slower burn. And, you know, to go back to the family dynamic early on, I've always been aware of the addiction issues in my family, and knew that I was susceptible, or, you know, I had some sort of genetic predisposition that I didn't fully understand, mm-hmm. but I knew it was there, and I could feel it. You know, I could definitely feel it kind of starting to take me, the grip of it, you know, getting more and more, evident and less comfortable and more painful and more or difficult to put any space between me and the last drink, you know, that I had.
Yeah, it was, yeah, yeah.
Those periods of time got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And you know, you can kind of feel the screws tightening a little bit. And I started to feel like I was in this bind, in my mind and in my body. I could feel these differences, and I could feel also that they were my hands on the wheel. They were my hands.
Yeah.
They were pulling the crank tighter and tighter and tighter. And even with some of that awareness, you know, there's not, I didn't have, you know, the bind hadn't gotten tight enough, or I hadn't, you know, the thing that happens when you start to know that a change is not just necessary, but possible, takes a long time. And, you know, it took a long time for me to get to that point. And, you know, I couldn't not just loosen the crank. I couldn't stop tightening it and tightening it. And, you know, that's kind of how it goes. And I just felt more and more squeezed. And I was losing things. I was getting in trouble. I was getting arrested. I was, you know, getting, you know, DWI. I was getting arrested for public intoxication, you know, just all of these sort of markers of somebody who's out of control.
Mm-hmm.
My body started to change. I started to gain a lot of weight. Started to feel really bad, really, really bad. You know, my stomach would hurt. My kidneys would hurt.
Yes.
So, you know, those sort of similar symptoms that you hear about, you know, the, you know, I don't really even know, as an addiction professional now, I the language changes all the time. I don't really think that I think we try to get away from terms like self-destruction, because that is not consistent, I think, with the messaging of, a chronic health condition,
mm-hmm.
but that is how I remember it. I remember it as feeling like I am destroying myself.
It's almost like self-destruction is a symptom of that health condition.
And that is the important message for me, I think, is to make sure that we talk about self-destruction as a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's valuable to lose sight of all of those phrases and all of those words that we've come up with.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that reframing them in the context of a chronic health condition is the way forward, so that we do have that familiar feeling. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be an advocate who doesn't use words or language that is true to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that takes some of my power away. But I also want to make sure that folks out there, people who are listening, understand that it's all a part of a really complicated health condition.
Yes. And if you just looked at it as like an equation, that when you take A plus B and add C, you get whatever that would equal. Like when you put alcohol in a mammal and have these behavior, like these behaviors just happen, and there is progression of the condition. There's tolerance and withdrawal and craving, and you need more to get the same effect. And then you need more to feel even normal. And so it's like, it's not like these people have a moral failing. It's just, this is what happens when you mix these things together.
Right.
Absolutely.
This is the outcome. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's completely separate from that person. And usually it's separate from their values. But they begin to internalize it as I'm bad, or something's wrong with me, or this is just my identity. I can't change that. I'm just whatever, you know? And it's like, no, we can stop the illness and start working towards recovery and uncover like your true self and your true values and identity.
Couldn't agree more. And I think those are all really important things to mention. I think now that we are as a culture understanding it as a chronic health condition, we have developed these really robust wraparound service, wraparound treatment models that include something like a prescriber and medication and maybe psychotherapy and group support and those sorts of things. And then you have coaches like Amanda and myself who do use tools like developing a discrepancy, you know, talking about values, right? And trying to help kind of demystify why are we behaving in these ways that are so out of balance with our values, you know?
Yeah.
Having somebody to help facilitate those conversations is a really powerful cognitive behavioral tool that we can use as coaches that is also super effective, or most effective, I'll say, when it is in sort of concert with a medication and, like I said, psychotherapy, and also connecting somebody to a hobby. Are they an artist? Have they lost sight of that? Is that something that we can help reintroduce into your life? You know, because there is a spiritual component, a purpose component that comes along, and that's just a human condition. Some of it manifests through addiction. But we're all in search of that thing. We're all in search of that thing, that practice that we can come back to, whether it is deliberately religious, or maybe it's a physical practice, maybe it's connecting with your family. Who knows? It's that thing that resonates with the individual. But for the addicted population, for folks, you know, who have some sort of an SUD, I think the SUD sort of overwhelms that, and we blame it. And again, we start to get into that, as you mentioned, that moral component of it. And that's not where it is. That's not where it is. That's where the symptoms can take us. The symptoms can take us to the place where we're stealing a car, or we're defrauding somebody, or we're dishonest with our family for years, and we're living these double lives, and we're doing these things that are associated with immorality of some kind. Mm-hmm. But that's the end game, you know. Way, way upstream from that is trauma, is the health condition of, you know, 5-6 generations, you know, of somebody who's just been exposed to, you know, an ACEs, right, an adverse childhood experience that then starts to manifest.
Yeah, your ACEs report.
For a 12-year-old as a pack of cigarettes and a joint, or, you know, whatever it may be these days, you know, or I say these days, that makes me sound like it's not been going on for a long time.
You're ancient.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so there is a social component, you know, for sure. And there is a morality component to it, but it's so much more complicated. And, you know, I know that oftentimes we're just trying to figure things out. We're just trying to assign a reason for behaviors, whatever they may be, but there's a lot of freedom, I think, in understanding that addiction and recovery are both these kind of weird, wild, wonderful things that are super complicated, and it's a spectrum like most things. It's worthwhile taking some time to try to listen and learn a little bit more about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when was that turning point for you, where you kind of started your path to recovery?
Yeah, I had gotten to the point where I didn't have anything really, except a few good friendships left. I was not completely estranged from my family, but it was not good. You know, I did not have robust family relationships really at all. And didn't think I ever would. I started to believe that, you know, the good part of my life was over and I would never get it back. And so I kind of held on to that. I kind of held on to thoughts like, well, I had a pretty good 10th grade year, you know, or, you know, I had I got to go to Europe when I was in high school. I remember, you know, I remember loving playing basketball with my friends. So I would kind of think back to these softer times, lighter times when I felt like I was thriving.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, okay, I had those things, but there's no way that I can turn back the clock on this. It's going to take me. It's going to kill me. It's going to kill me young, and that's just the way it's going to go. So after maybe a couple of years of feeling like that, I think I just got, I don't know. It wasn't necessarily an epiphany. I do remember telling a couple of friends that, okay, look, I've got a birthday coming up, a couple of months. I'm going to get real trashed on my birthday. I'm just going to go crazy. And then I'm going to try to stop after that. That was in 2012. And I think that I sort of created what, you know, looking back now, was an accountability measure. Maybe 3 months before.
Yeah, by sharing it with someone.
Yeah, by sharing it with somebody. And there it went, and it kind of unfolded just like that. I had this crazy birthday and, you know, got real sick. And the next day I sort of shook it off and walked to an AA meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. That was about 11 and a half years ago.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, AA was a good thing. It was a good place to just go, you know. It's like that practice that I mentioned earlier. It's just that kind of thing that you can just kind of stay attached to. But really, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, you know, 10 days into this experiment, I just was kind of lifted. I just felt, you know what, I think that I'm past that part of my life. I don't think I'm going to drink anymore. And we're all familiar with the one day at a time slogan. Yeah. And it's efficacy, which I believe in. But I just felt like, you know, I have a lot of work to do to put my life back together. But I don't feel like I have to put too much focus on abstinence, because I just don't want to drink. I do not want to drink.
Had left you. It's almost like you'd fallen out of love with it. You thought for what it was, and it had no allure anymore.
The shine was completely gone, and had been for a long time. I think really what happened was, or what may have happened was, you know, associated with 15 years of intense, you know, drug and alcohol use, was this utter lack of self-belief that I could get away from it. Yeah. And it only took, I think it just took a couple of days to restore at least the enough of a belief that, oh, I don't have to do that to get through the day. You know, it was just kind of that electrical connection that needed to be made, that I can actually get beyond 24 hours without putting this into my body. I can survive it. And when I realized I could survive it, I felt like, okay, I think I'm just ready for a different way of life.
A different way of living. Kind of change your concept.
Right.
That's incredible. Yeah. How old were you when you got sober, Jonathan?
32. I just turned 32. Okay. Yeah.
So still pretty young.
Yeah, relatively speaking. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but at the same time, I do think there's something to the age, being in the 30s and the maturity level and just feeling more responsible, maybe. I don't know. I feel like quitting drinking, for me, at least in my 30s, felt doable, whereas in my 20s, when I thought about not drinking anymore in my 20s, it just seemed absolutely crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like there was an aging out kind of component to my story, too. I mean, I was the same in my 20s. I was so wrapped up in it. It was everything. I mean, nothing in my life was separate from drinking, really. Nothing. I didn't have any relationships that weren't connected to it. I didn't have any strife that wasn't connected to it. I didn't have any, you know, my job was totally connected to it. And I could not see beyond that whatsoever. And I don't know that I could when I first walked into an AA meeting. But again, it was like this, I feel, you know, looking, and I'm kind of remembering that weekend right now, And it does kind of feel just like it's this simple sort of electrical impulse, a little electrical neurological connection in my mind that made it true that I didn't have to have a drink, you know, every couple of hours.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like you realize, oh, actually it's possible even for me, I can do this.
Right. Which previously, as I shared, thought this is going to take me to my grave.
Yeah.
And at whatever pace that's going to happen, that is certain. There is no other outcome for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is like step one of the 12th step, like admitting, like you're like, I am powerless, like this is going to kill me. And then realizing, oh, but there is one other option.
Yeah, there is another option. Right. Sometimes, you know, working in this field and having these memories of how difficult it was and what my life is like now versus that time, sometimes it does kind of strike me as miraculous. But I don't really tend to prescribe to that, to the miracle kind of explanation, personally or as a in the conversations that I have with other folks. It feels miraculous. It does. It does feel like that those first three steps in AA are, you know, there's this miracle that's taking place. And maybe there is. I don't know, to be sure.
It is like, in a way, it's an awakening of sorts, an ability to see other possibilities that maybe were there before and you just couldn't see them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and you're so sort of obscured from any other outcome that I think once some visibility is introduced, it's overwhelming and it's so emotional, you know, because it's such a difficult life path. But it's also, you know, I've said this before, that's where the adversity comes, you know, for me and for so many other people, the people that we are today in recovery. This version that you're seeing, this person that you're meeting for the first time, Jane, and this person that, you know, Amanda, that you know for the last few months, did not exist in my mind at all. You know, this was an impossible outcome. So, you know, again, it's like the words like impossible and feeling so trapped kind of give way to these feelings of miraculousness when these different outcomes are achieved. But really, I do think that it's also really important to acknowledge how possible it is. And it doesn't take a miracle, even though it feels like it does. We can get better.
It feels like a miracle.
It feels like a miracle, but we can all, you know, recovery is possible for everybody, you know.
The miracle is available to everyone. It's almost like if you put A plus B plus C and you get the outcome of addiction. If you follow a recovery program and put A plus C there, maybe that equals a miracle. And believing it's possible for you is the first step.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Jonathan, what does your life look like now?
Now it looks like it's pretty tame. It's pretty predictable. It is pretty routine, which has been for me, creating a routine and having introducing all of these measures of predictability into my life is really what has sustained what is a much healthier existence. I am really driven by a pretty robust exercise regimen. I've been kind of eating and exercising in a specific way for the last 6 or 7 years. I got really deep into running and have been doing that since just around the pandemic. That's taken up a lot of my free time. And that's a major part of my routine. I still cook a lot. My favorite thing to do is make my wife dinner. I can't wait to go to the grocery store. I love the produce section. I love the meat counter. You know, I love to look at shelves of organized food. It's a lot of family time. It's a lot of cooking. It's a lot of exercise, yoga, you know, things like this. And then I work in recovery. So for 40 hours a week, I have a pretty standard kind of a 9-to-5 work schedule. I try to introduce people to the possibility of recovery. And that's kind of it. Try to take a vacation now and then. I love to hike. Outdoors, eating, exercising, and recovery. That's kind of the nutshell.
I love that. Do you have any advice, or what would you say to somebody who is in the spot where you were back in early 2012? Anything that would have been helpful for you to hear at that time?
Well, I know that what I share with folks who are particularly are still having a really difficult time getting connected to recovery in a consistent way, maybe there's a series of returns to use, or they're still kind of vacillating between stages of change, and struggling with the self-belief piece of recovery, is that I was totally convinced that it would never happen for me. I knew I didn't have the strength. I knew I didn't have skills. I knew I didn't have just what it took, whatever that was. It was elusive to me at the time and always would be. And I was wrong. I was wrong about that. You can get connected to recovery. I think from sort of a mantra place, I would say to find hope and turn it into purpose.
Yeah.
That's something that I will repeat over and over again. Something that I still have to say to myself sometimes when I get into a rut. Something I say to loved ones who are struggling with issues that aren't related to addiction. Find hope and turn it into purpose. Yeah.
I love that. It's beautiful.
I agree.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and for doing the work that you do. It's important work.
Yeah, you got it. Super happy to be here. And thanks for making the space for me.
Thank you so much for listening. We truly value each one of you. In support of the podcast, please follow or subscribe to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast.
We'd love to connect with you via Instagram at Jane W. Ballard and or DFW Yoga Girl. Sending you love and light.